It's Friday, April 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, North Korea launches another suspected missile. Amnesty International condemns a refugee agreement signed by Turkey and the European Union.
What we're seeing is the construction, first of Fortress Europe, but now Fortress Turkey.
And internationally renowned architect Zaha Hadad dies at the age of 65. It's all ahead. South Korean media say North Korea has fired a suspected ballistic missile off its east coast in the latest of several tests this year. South Korea's Yonhap News Service said the surface-to-air missile launched into the Sea of Japan at midday Friday. South Korea's defense ministry confirmed the report to the French news agency, but said its range and precise trajectory could not be confirmed. It said the launch came from the eastern city of Sondok. I spoke with VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul and asked him the apparent reason for the continuing tests.
It seems to be provocation. It seems to be a weekly event here that North Korea either launches a medium or a short-range missile, and there does not seem to be a technological test that it seems to be trying to improve its technology or range. It seems to be just trying to send a message that they're here and they're not happy with the present situation, and it's almost kind of a protest launch.
This is going on, as of course here in Washington, a number of world leaders are meeting to discuss international nuclear security. And North Korea is certainly one of the topics very much under discussion. Could this be another reason?
Yes, and what you had yesterday in the nuclear summit in Washington, you had the three allies here in Asia, the U.S., Japan, and South Korea. The leaders from all three countries met, and they underlined their support for these very new, tough, harsh sanctions against North Korea. And so, yes, it could very much be seen as an act of defiance when South Korea and Japan and the U.S. are recommitting their belief and commitment to pressure North Korea to compromise their stance on developing nuclear weapons. And at the same time, President Xi Jinping was there, who also tried to reach out to North Korea and urge North Korea to re-engage through negotiation. This was North Korea's response.
Brian, you've also done some reporting about North Korea apparently jamming GPS signals in South Korea. What have you found out?
Yes, this was something that was reported today by the Ministry of Defense. The report says that it's been happening now for almost a month, and that at two locations in North Korea, North Korea sent out these jamming radio wave transmission stations that block GPS transmissions or disrupt GPS transmissions, and that have the ability to disrupt cellular service, navigation systems for ships and for aircraft, and that a number of ships actually had to turn around and go back to port because they had some issues with their GPS that they thought was internal, but was in fact due to this jamming that was happening from North Korea. So it's just another provocation. It's another way for North Korea to try to make life a little bit more miserable for the South, and as its life is becoming more difficult because of the sanctions.
VOA Northeast Asia correspondent Brian Padden in Seoul. Well, joining me in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky with a look at what's trending. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, today's April Fool's Day. We'll get to that in a little bit, because this story, as we were talking about, I thought at first it was an April Fool's joke, but it is an actual story according to the Associated Press. And kind of along the lines of what Brian was talking about with North Korea blocking GPS, the Associated Press is reporting that North Korea is now blocking Twitter, Facebook, some South Korean media websites and Voice of America as well within the country. Now, I thought this was an April Fool's joke because I said, how many people could possibly be on Twitter and Facebook in North Korea? That doesn't seem like something they would have access to already. But apparently, there's a very few number of people that can access the internet, but they were able to access it previously. And also, foreigners coming into the country were able to access these sites. Now they've all been blocked. Interestingly, Instagram is apparently still up and running.
That is interesting.
So we'll see how this plays out. The North Korean announcement said that it was going to block these sites for a certain period of time. Didn't really give an idea of how long that might be, but just another case of some of the restrictions that they're putting in place and the power of social media. They're clearly recognizing that it's a powerful tool for people to communicate and share ideas, and that is probably the reason why they're shutting it down.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that Instagram continues.
And Instagram continues. Yeah. But as I said, it is April Fool's Day, so happy April Fool's Day to you.
Okay.
It's lots of talk about it on social media. Some great jokes so far. I think my favorite has been somebody posted an article that said Donald Trump's going to announce that his candidacy was all an elaborate April Fool's Day joke. But a lot of people using, both sides of the aisle, political candidates saying this is the April Fool in this election year. And a very nice tweet that I saw, somebody said, it is April Fool's Day, but don't make fun of people's appearances or disabilities. Let's all have good fun, but don't make it personal. So I think that's a good thing to keep in mind. It's a nice day to make some jokes and have fun, but don't make them at people's expense.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Italian astronomers say they have observed something never seen before, a fast-spinning pulsar in the nearby Andromeda, or M31, galaxy. Their findings were published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. Pulsars are spinning neutron stars that produce a focused beam of magnetic radiation, which some say resembles a lighthouse beacon. Since pulsars rotate, their light can appear to be pulsating. Neutron stars are the compacted remains of an enormous star that exploded in a supernova. While pulsars and other rotating neutron stars are quite common in our own Milky Way, this marks the first time such an object has been spotted in the Andromeda Galaxy. The astronomers made their discovery as they were reviewing past data from the European Space Agency's XMM Newton Space Telescope. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, the world of architecture mourns the death of Zaha Hadid. The European Union and Greece will begin sending migrants from the Greek Isles to Turkey on Monday. The deportation plan, which includes Syrians, is part of a deal reached 2 weeks ago between the Turkish government and the EU. The agreement aims to ease Europe's migrant crisis, but human rights advocates and leftists in Europe have protested the deal, saying it arises from xenophobia. Well, in a new report, the London-based human rights group Amnesty International criticized the deal, saying Ankara has expelled Syrians on a daily basis since the beginning of this year. I spoke with Amnesty's Turkey researcher Andrew Gardner in Istanbul and asked him to elaborate on his organization's findings.
Well, these latest returns are really shocking in the inhumanity that we've seen and also the scale of them. It's not the first time we've documented forced returns of Syrian refugees from Turkey, but the scale that we're seeing. What we've seen is we've documented two cases in detail where, in one case, over 100, in the other case, over 200 Syrian men, women, and children were forced from Turkey's bordering Hatay province back into Syria. So what we're receiving from the people on the ground is really consistent reports that these mass returns, they're happening on a regular, even an almost daily basis for the past 6 to 8 weeks. So potentially it could mean that thousands of Syrian refugees have been forced back into Syria.
Now, what are the conditions for these people like? And do these include women and children?
They certainly include women and children. I mean, the people we've spoke to and the Syrian refugees ourselves who gave testimonies about their family members and indeed people we've spoken to who've been pushed back into Syria and who we spoke to by phone whilst they're actually in camps in Syria, they told us examples of, for example, an 8-month pregnant woman who was forced back into Syria, three children under the age of 11 who were apprehended in Turkey and sent back to Syria, you know, so are now separated from their parents who remain in Turkey. So the conditions also which people are being sent back to are abysmal. They're mainly in camps close to the Turkish border, camps without running water, without sanitation, where the dangers include reports of kidnappings for ransom. So it's really a situation which is completely unsafe for anyone, let alone small young children or pregnant women.
Why do you believe that this is illegal under international law?
Well, it's clearly illegal under international law. The principle that no one should be forced back to a country where they may face persecution, human rights abuses, is a very well-established principle in international law. It's also a very clear requirement in Turkish law that people shouldn't be sent back. So there's no real debate about whether this is legal or otherwise. It's just simply not just unlawful, but completely immoral to send people back to this situation.
In this agreement signed between Turkey and the European Union earlier this month, your organization talks about the EU's courting of Turkey. What do you mean by that?
Well, the EU-Turkey refugee deal in itself is unlawful. You simply can't have a lawful plan where the fundamental part of it is blanket returns of refugees and asylum seekers. I mean, but what we've also seen is a knock-on effect. So when Turkey's been negotiating these series of deals with the EU, we've seen the situation in many ways get worse for refugees and asylum seekers in the country. So we've seen last year unlawful detentions of Syrian and also Iraqi refugees and asylum seekers. So people held in detention without access to their family members, without access to lawyers, and some of those people pushed back to Syria ahead of this latest series of mass returns that we've documented. So in a sense, it's Turkey learning from the EU, and what we're seeing is the construction first of Fortress Europe, but now Fortress Turkey, where it's incredibly difficult and dangerous to cross the border. People face illegal pushbacks, and Turkey really closing the border to new arrivals of refugees. There are already a huge number of refugees in Turkey, some 2.7 million Syrian refugees alone. So really the solution needs to be for the EU and other rich states to share the responsibility for accommodating these refugees, and for Turkey certainly to keep its border open to refugees, and for these refugees who are already in Turkey and those people who need to come into Turkey, for this responsibility to be shared between Turkey, between the EU, and other states who should be taking responsibility for resettlement.
Amnesty International's Turkey researcher Andrew Gardner speaking from Istanbul. Republican frontrunner Donald Trump says he feels the United States is getting a raw deal from the framework of international alliances forged after the Second World War, including the Geneva Conventions, which he says make U.S. troops afraid to fight. He vows to make changes if he's elected president in November. Analyst Thomas Wright and other experts say Trump's proposals would amount to a revolution in U.S. foreign policy, as VOA Cindy Sain reports from Washington.
Billionaire Donald Trump has upended the Republican presidential campaign and would now upend U.S. foreign policy. Trump says the United States is a nation with crumbling infrastructure,
and we have to build a wall
that can no longer afford to be the world's policeman. At a recent CNN town hall, he challenged a bedrock alliance.
Let me tell you, NATO is obsolete. It was 67 years, or it's over 60 years old. It is many countries, doesn't cover terrorism, okay? It covers the Soviet Union, which is no longer in existence. And NATO has to either be rejiggered, changed for the better.
Trump's comments on NATO and on the U.S. paying too much for Japan's and South Korea's security were not just casual remarks, but reflect his long-held views, says international policy expert Thomas Wright.
He has a big problem with America's alliances in Asia and in Europe and in the Middle East. He's got a big problem with all of the trade deals and different types of economic engagement the U.S. has engaged with over in recent decades. And he, you know, he's looking to develop closer ties to authoritarian regimes like Putin's Russia. So that's a that would amount to a revolution, really, in U.S. foreign policy.
Trump says General Republican Dunford, Senator Jeff Sessions heads his team of foreign policy advisors, but has been slow to release names of a full team. Wright says there is one simple reason.
It's that the Republican foreign policy establishment does not agree with him. They are shocked and opposed to what he is proposing. And so they don't want to sign on with him. So he's finding it hard to find people and because of a legitimate disagreement.
Wright argues that if elected, Trump's isolationist views could remove a pillar of world stability, U.S. leadership. Cindy Sain, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. The world's most famous female architect, 65-year-old Baghdad native Zaha Hadid, whose groundbreaking designs, including the Aquatic Center for the London 2012 Games and a stadium for the 2022 Qatar World Cup, has died in Miami. International Edition's David Byrd spoke with architect Thomas Leslie, the Pickard Chilton Professor in Architecture at Iowa State University, about Hadid's contributions to architecture and humanity.
She came out of a background in painting, and I think really offered a kind of freedom or the idea of a freedom for architectural form and architectural meaning that was very, very new, especially in the 1980s. I think also you can't underestimate the fact that she was a very strong female figure in a field that that needs those. And she was also, I think, one of the architects who really showed how architecture can be an important part of sort of international marketing, international branding, that architecture is a way for countries and corporations to make statements about their outlook was increasingly important at the end of last century, the beginning of this one.
She is known for the Italian National Museum of 21st Century Art in Rome, the Rosenthal Center for Contemporary Art in Cincinnati, and even the Guangzhou Opera House in China. She also was a winner of the Pritzker Architecture Prize. Now, what exactly is that?
Well, the Pritzker is often referred to as architecture's Nobel Prize. It's given annually to a living architect who has been the most influential over the past generation, who the committee feels has really set the agenda. And it was a remarkable moment when she won. She was the first woman to win, and it seemed long overdue at the time when she received it.
And she also was a teacher. She was handing on her knowledge to other people as well. Isn't that correct?
That's true. She taught extensively, and I think that, in addition to the buildings, that's certainly one of her most powerful legacies. Her students, of course, went on to great things, many of them in the vein of the kind of exuberant formalism that she was known for, many, I think, also slightly in rebellion against that. But I think as a student, it always helps to have a strong figure that you can either work with or you can work against in your career. And she was very powerful in that sense.
And her designs speak beyond their years as well. Looking at the Aquatic Center in London and some of her other designs, she broke some barriers, and people are probably going to be studying her work for years, right?
That's absolutely the case. Her work was, as I said, exuberant and often at odds with structural or constructional, what we might have regarded as structural or constructional truths, also occasionally at odds with the context, usually in ways that were provocative and interesting, sometimes in ways that drew controversy, but always in ways that grabbed attention, both for the architecture and for the spaces around them. And I think the power of her forms, as I said, was often at odds with some of the things that architects and sometimes urban planners hold dear. And that, I think, you know, her legacy will be as someone who poked and prodded at things that we took for granted for generations. Her work will absolutely be studied years into the future, both for what it promised and also, I think, what it rebelled against.
That's Thomas Leslie, professor of architecture at Iowa State University in Ames, Iowa. He spoke with International Edition's David Byrd. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Like many other countries in the world, Bangladesh faces the threat of violent extremism. In Bangladesh, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell, said groups like Jamaat-ul-Mujahideen Bangladesh have long targeted innocent people in movie theaters, political gatherings, and New Year's celebrations. Recently, extremists stabbed a man to death in Kurigram because he converted to a new faith. This follows recent attacks against Shia Muslims, Hindus, and Christians. In the last few years, four bloggers have been murdered in cold blood. Bloggers like Avijit Roy, who was hacked to death at a book fair right here in Dhaka. These barbaric acts are not just attacks on the Bangladeshi people, but also their long tradition of open debate, religious tolerance, and moderation. Governments have an important role to play beyond deploying armies and police to protect people from extremist threats. Governments must govern justly and not use the fight against terrorism to undermine democracy and the rule of law by allowing detentions, excessive force, or restrictions on political space. These kinds of actions can actually drive people toward extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell. But governments cannot do it alone. Countering violent extremism requires empowering people, including religious leaders, women, businesses, and young people. But in order to unleash the talents of individuals in the fight against violent extremism, freedom of speech must be protected. As Undersecretary Sewell said, this includes protecting their fundamental freedoms to peacefully speak out, practice their faith or not practice one, and to organize on behalf of their beliefs. These are universal human rights, but they are also sources of resilience against violent extremism. When people are free to speak without reprisal about corruption or abuse by local police forces or feelings of marginalization, they can alert governments to address potential dangers of radicalization before they grow. In the face of violent extremism, said Undersecretary Sewell, I have no doubt that the people of Bangladesh will prevail if they stay true to their deepest traditions of inclusion, democracy, and trusting in the power of people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.